This is Beyond the Resume, the podcast that brings you the stories, advice, and insights behind some of the most successful people in real estate. Beyond the Resume is brought to you by Jackson Lucas Executive Search, the industry leader in human capital solutions. Here is Chris Papa and Lisa Flicker.
Jeffrey, thanks for coming on the podcast. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Happy to be here.
So, Jeffrey, our producer tells us that your love for the business, real estate business, or just business in general, started as a 14-year-old pushing shopping carts.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that young man and how that got your hunger for business going.
Sure. So, we owned a chain of grocery stores, and my dad always felt that we should be involved in, from a young age. And so I was out there at 14 years old in the rain and the snow and pushing shopping carts to collect them as, part of my area of responsibility. And then, as we got older, I did every single job in a supermarket. So you name it, I was there. But one story, my younger brother, who was 7 at the time, used to run around the store and he would cause mayhem because he would actually go to the deli department and then he would start carving deli meats, And he's 7 years old, and then it would freak out the store manager because he'd be like, "Oh my God, you're gonna cut your finger off!" And so, he was always having fun that way, and so it wasn't so much fun for the folks in the store. They're like, "My God,
it's gonna call havoc."
Yeah,
as long as he was cutting liverwurst, because that's everyone can use a free slice of liverwurst. Where did you grow up? Where are these grocery stores, or where were they?
So in Orange County, New York. So my grandfather started a corner grocery store in a little town called Florida, New York, which is a little hamlet. And if you think about, so I think about him a lot because in today's age, so he would get up at 3 a.m. He would drive to New York City. He would get fruits, vegetables, meats, fish, all fresh. Drive back to the store for the store opening at 7. He would stay in the store till 11 p.m. He would then go home, and he did that 6 days a week for 15 years. And so he established a reputation as having, the freshest items available on a daily basis. And so this little tiny corner grocery store, had a really strong following. And then he decided that he was going to open up a bigger store. So he was, and I haven't heard any earlier, but in the early 50s, he sold 6% savings bonds to all of his customers to raise the funds to open a bigger 30,000 square foot store. And so, I always say he was probably one of the first crowdsource funding entrepreneurs out there because, that was the only way he could raise the funds at that point in time. He had a 6th grade education. He had to leave school in order to take care of his family. And so, he was just a very smart, very hard worker.
Embodies the hard times make strong people, right?
It does. It does. And, I think about it today and I think about, so my work ethic, it's similar, but I look around today and I say, all right, many of us, a lot of us have that same work ethic and some do not. And it's, we have sort of a set of core values in our company that we abide by. And so one of the fun things I get to do is that I get to be the last person that is the interviewer in a hire for individuals. And so my question always is never about what your skill sets are, but my question is always, from the last place you worked, can you tell me what the core values are? And can you tell me how they are demonstrated in a day-to-day basis at your job? And so it's pretty interesting, right? Because, and I ask at restaurants, when I ask servers at high-end restaurants, do you know what your restaurant's core values are? And some do and some don't. And so it's just an interesting view because we try to adhere to our core values in everything that we do.
What are they?
Yeah, let's hear them.
What are your core values?
What are my core values?
No, the company's, the big V.
What are our core values? Well, they're right on our website. So I don't know if we have a lot of time, but so let me ask you guys just a quick question. I'm happy to talk about our core values. I'm happy to talk about who we are as a company. you know, when I think about embodying your core values, I say, all right, how do you actually demonstrate and how do companies actually adhere to? So I think about COVID, right? So COVID came along. We're a real estate company. Our tenants stopped paying rent and we were concerned about what we would cash flow coming in. But our core values, one of our core values is family first. And so what does that mean? So that means we paid all of our vendors in full, regardless of whether our tenants are paying us. We, you know, basically let our vendors know, don't fire anybody. Don't let it put furlough anybody, but pay your employees. We offered assistance to any of our employees whose spouses may have been put out of work because of the COVID. We didn't let anybody go. We had no forbearance or discussions with any banks about any modifications to any loans. And that's just part of who we are. And so I always like to say, and I do this in interviews, but I always like to say, can you demonstrate who you are by the actions that you undertake during times of stress? When everything is great,
right,
we're all happy, right? Everything is good. When things are really stressful and when things are very difficult, that's when who you are as an individual, that's when who you are as a company really comes through. And I, you know, one other quick comment about core values along those lines, we dealt with various tenants during that period of time. And there were two extremes between those tenants. One tenant sent us a letter basically saying that we value who you are as a partner, and we will not stop paying rent because of that partnership. And then another tenant is, you know, we're gonna stop paying rent, and but we value as a partner, but we're not gonna pay you any rent, even though our sales are really strong and we're not really impacted by COVID. So two very, you know, big extremes.
Tell us about, so I mean, you're in the shopping center business, just like your grandfather, correct, right?
Yeah.
Just like your father.
So yeah, just well, my father and grandfather, both of them.
You took the shopping cart and you drove it all the way to the CEO's office.
Yeah. Well, it took many years to get there.
Yeah. Tell us about that. Did you, like, you learned the operational of the shopping center and, like, how did you get involved with, like, did you realize one day, wait a minute, we're not in the shopping center business, we're in the real estate business?
So it's really kind of interesting. So quick story. My grandfather, you know, the way he grew the business was he and my grandmother used to drive around. And he used to buy up swaths of land, like big areas of land. And then he would build a supermarket and a shopping center, which we owned. Then he would sell off the balance of the property to the various other retailers that came into the market from the draw of the supermarket. And then he used that funding to build the next store. So, you know, that's actually from a real estate basis, that's how he actually built the company, was to be able to use the benefits of the supermarket and the draw that supermarket created and then use that to fund the growth of the company over a period of years. And so, and yet at the end of the day, we ended up being a real estate company and a supermarket operating company. We sold the supermarket operating company in 1987, many, many years ago. And we were part of a co-op called ShopRite. Mm-hmm. So at the time we were the largest member of the of Wakefern, which is the ShopRite co-op. And so we sold the operating business and kept the real estate. And so I came back in the mid 90s and, you know, we've just expanded our business since that time.
And so what have you been doing since that time? So are you're running the real estate?
Yeah. So it's all real estate. So I started off managing our family assets and then decided that this was kind of fun and looked to expand our company and our growth. And so we started to move our assets to the southern part of the United States to get sort of like portfolio management, right? Change the risk profile of our portfolio based upon different geographic locations, just different demographics, different capital structures. And so we started to manage our real estate like a portfolio, right? Like a stock portfolio, right? Different areas, different choices, different risks. And then as I was doing that, friends would call me and say, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm buying a shopping center. Can I join you? I'm like, okay. But, you know, And then I started adding individual investors, and then we started to grow that business. And so today, I think we probably have maybe 1,500 investors, and wow, mostly all friends and family and relationships that we've established over many, many years. And then we have about $2 to $2.5 billion of real estate across this mostly southern part of the United States.
How have you seen shopping center real estate change since you joined?
Jeez, do you have an hour? Do you have two? I mean, you know, it's changed, you know, it continues to evolve and change. It's really interesting. I believe that, you know, we went through a big change in the 90s. We went through a big change in the great financial crisis in the aughts, right? 2008, 2009. We went through a change during COVID, right? When for us, you know, retail was frowned upon, right? We were all going to go out of business. The internet was taking everybody over. But it turns out that having a store is one of the most efficient ways to deliver a product to a customer in a market. So, uh-huh. You know, so today, real estate and our segment, which is, you know, retail open air centers, a highly desirable product category to invest in. And so it's become a time where we were the only investors, right? And there weren't a lot of people investing because we were taking risk associated with the assets. So we were buying assets when they were well out of favor. And then to today, where a lot of times we can't even acquire the assets because it's so aggressively priced that, you know, we can't get the returns that we need for our investors. And so we've gone from, you know, all the way from, you know, people are calling us crazy for investing in retail real estate and big box centers to, you know, now there's so much capital out in the marketplace today that's looking to acquire the same assets that we own that it's more difficult to acquire those assets.
And I would imagine a grocery store is extremely valuable. Like when you think about what people want, they want community, they want to be around other people. I would think you'd have the infrastructure to kind of create real community. Everyone needs groceries, right?
Yeah. And we don't specialize in grocery centers and grocery anchored centers because for us, you know, that's more neighborhood community and it's also more stable over a very long period of time and provides, you know, doesn't provide the growth in returns that we were looking for. And so we specialize in large format open air centers. And so our centers, some of them are 1 million square feet, 800,000 square feet, and they're little, you know, communities within themselves. And so that's what we like to specialize in. And though our tenants are Best Buy and, you know, Ross Stores and Marshalls and, you know, a lot of our centers have Target in them. We don't have any Walmart. So we're not really specialized in the Walmart side, but that's what we specialize in. So that type of product.
And when you're buying an asset, what are you looking for? Are you looking to, we can add value here, we can better manage it? Like what's sort of the key characteristics of an asset that you're looking at?
Yeah, typically, I mean, we're looking for a, you know, let's call it a low teens IRR return metrics on a conservative basis. And we're looking to have an opportunity to add value over a period of time. What's interesting in our business today is that most of these shopping centers that are currently in operation have been built, were built in the aughts. And so most of the leases were, you know, 20 year leases, right? So now we're getting to a period of time where within the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to start being able to recycle some of the spaces as tenants come out of their option periods and don't have the ability to continue with 5-year options. And now we're getting to a point where we can actually look at mark to market for various spaces that and the centers that we own, which is important to us because, you know, many of these centers and tenants have, you know, 20-year leases, right? 10-year initial term, 2, 3, 4, 5-year options. Supermarkets could go off 50 years. I mean, when we used to do supermarket leases, right, they were 20-year initial terms with four or five options, right? So they're out 25 years. So they're out close to 50 years on their initial term, on their term for supermarket leases.
Yeah.
So those values are not, you know, those options don't say, you know, your rent will be market rent, right? So
yeah, and who would have thought, like, I mean, the retail would go through fluctuations. I mean, I don't know. Like, yeah, you always gonna need stores to buy stuff, but then things change. Now technology and you get warehousing, and like, you know, I feel like Amazon bought Whole Foods because they needed a place to store their food to deliver to people. So like what do you think is going to be moving into the next wave of retail?
Well, so we look at retail as omni-channel, right? So if you think about retail has become a distribution system, right? So the most effective retailers are those that have taken their stores and provided multiple ways to deliver the product to the consumer. And that, you know, those ways are every, you know, all the ways that you know, right? It's through through DoorDash delivery, or they've got to deal with a 2-hour delivery provider. It's drive up, park in a space, and the app notifies the store that you're sitting there, and they deliver your product within 2 minutes to your car. It's walk in and pick it up at the pickup space. It's do your own shopping. What's interesting that people don't think about, though, is you've got shifting of cost. So if you think about delivery systems, right now, there's no difference in price generally from you ordering it on your app, someone picking it in the store and delivering it to your car when you pull up outside, right?
Yeah, it's usually like a tip or something sometimes, right?
Right. But traditionally, you would go into the store, you would push your cart around, you would pick the stuff off the shelves, you would go to the checkout, you would hand it through the checkout, you'd pack it, you take it to your car, you place it in your car, and you drive off. So now you've replaced the labor component of that entire piece that you were doing with a store associate doing that without an additional charge that the store associate, you know, that the store is receiving for that additional labor cost. And so today, that labor cost is being absorbed by the retailers. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future because, you know, you've got shifting of work here between the consumer and the retailer.
They're getting us hooked. We're getting hooked to the service now. Oh, we're gonna pay more for that.
I was out in West Hollywood 2 weeks ago, and it was really fascinating to me because they had these little like drone type things that stores they work for the stores, so they would drive in, they would get their deliveries, and then you see them just like going up and down the block delivering stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so
maybe that's the replacement.
Right. And there'll be a lot of technology enhancement as you look at the shifting of labor costs. And if you consider a store product as an omnidirectional delivery place, right, or system, right? So every store that's going to be successful in the future, I believe anyway, we believe, have to adhere to some sort of omnidirectional delivery product, right, that where they can deliver product in multiple ways to the consumer based upon what the consumer wants. Question is, how does that delivery system morph? You just described one way, right? You saw Amazon's testing drones, right? So they're testing delivery systems with drones. It's going to be really fascinating to see how that delivery system changes over time. But retail is actually one of the least expensive ways to house, store, and have touch points with customers to deliver products. And that wasn't really realized during COVID, during the internet run-up, during other places. But, you know, there's data out there which says that if you open a store, your sales within that market area are going to go up a percentage. If you close a store in that market area, your sales are going to drop, both internet-based and then, of course, store-based. And so, you know, it also becomes an advertising tool. And if you think about how we measure success, so retailers traditionally have always measured success via the store, you know, sales per square foot. You hear that all the time. But it's really tough today to start thinking about measuring success with sales per square foot because sales per square foot is measured by just the product that's being delivered out of that store. But that product, you know, and that delivery, someone could come into that store and order something or have it delivered the next day to their house, and that may not necessarily be recorded as part of the store sales. And so there's lots of fun stuff going on.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you see like Warby Parker, you know, Warby Parker now is, you know, places that you started online and now it's got, you know, store retail or street retails.
And there's lots of those.
One of the most fascinating things I read years ago was that Amazon filed patents for like in the sky and like submarine, like under the ground, under the water for last mile logistics. And I thought to myself, like, if they know that everybody in my neighborhood likes Colgate toothpaste, it basically is going to like fall from the sky at some point.
Yeah, it might. And, you know, you today, I mean, my daughter, you know, educated me on the benefits of Instacart, which I had never used.
It's incredible. And
it really is incredible. I mean, pretty fascinating, the benefits that Instacart sees. And so, and other products like that, I think there are probably other, I you know, only mention that because that's the only one I know, but I'm sure there are other products similar to that, that are out there that are providing delivery systems, and people are involved. If you remember, right, taxis, you had to buy a taxi cab to run a taxi. Now you have your own car to be an Uber driver and,
right.
You know, all sorts of fun changes going on.
What if there's some people listening who want to get into the retail investment business? Like, what's the skill set needed they should acquire in order to become successful in this business?
Well, you know, just like most real estate, it's a finance business first. And so if someone asks me that question, my first response is you need to take some finance classes and really understand the basic of finance. Because if you think about what real estate is, right? Real estate is a group of cash flows that are coming in that is a bunch of retailers paying you rent. And then the idea is, okay, now you have to evaluate how likely are you going to receive that rent? And then, you know, how long will that rent continue? And will that rent stop at any time in the future? Because, you know, the shopping center is in a bad location or whatever, or, you know, demographics change. And so I always say a finance background is always helpful. And then, you know, you can get experience in the brokerage business and you can be an analyst. There are lots of ways coming out of college that you can actually interact and be in real estate.
Tell us about what Big V stands for and why you chose that as a name.
So I didn't choose it. So back in 1942, when my grandfather opened up the corner grocery store, it was called Victory Markets. And Victory Markets, because it was, you know, during World War II, right? So Victory Markets. Then there was another Victory Markets supermarket chain in upstate New York, and they sued him. And so for having the same name, so he had to change the name, and that's where Big V came from. And so just became Big V. So we just continued that traditional name from the 40s. And that's what we're using
today.
What a
cool story, man. I wish I had some story about that with my grandfather's bits.
I know,
yeah,
right?
You know, yeah. The funnest part in it and the lessons that I try to impart, because I think about my grandfather a lot. You think about leaving school at sixth grade, having to support his family, working from 3 a.m. to 11 p.m. every night for 15 years to be able to build his business. And I think about the lessons that you learn about that. You know, success is not, for most of us, success is not immediate, right? Success is picking a path, determining what that path is, believing in what you do, and then doing it over a long period of time. And so our success is very similar to that. Right? We picked a path many years ago in the type of real estate that we liked, and we just continued to build over a period of time slowly to be successful today. And so, you know, that's always my advice is, you know, getting rich quick, seeing really, you know, success really fast. It's out there, but it's a lot. You have a bigger chance of success if you pick a path that you believe in and, you know, work towards that path over a long period of time.
Yeah, it's a get rich slowly.
Right.
It is a get rich slowly. And people ask me, I've been doing this for 40 years and they're like, how'd you get to where you are? I'm like, slowly. Right? Slowly. I mean, it's a believing in what you do on a day in, day out basis. And so, you know, when real estate was not in favor, we believed in what we did and we still invested in it and we still worked in it. When now the real estate segment that we work in is in favor and we're still, you know, believing in what we do and continuing to work in our business. And we've been through, you know, really difficult times and we've been through really good times. And, you know, it's just the longevity of the business and staying focused on what you like to do.
Yeah.
Through the bad times, which is always the hardest.
Through the bad times. Right? Yeah. And, you know, as we talked about, I mean, you know, COVID was difficult, right?
Yeah.
But you stay focused. You adhere to your core values, right? Which is what we did, right? We adhered to our core values. And we came out of COVID in a much, much better place than we went in. And people recognize when you adhere to your core values and when you have, when you are a quality organization that attempts to continue to do what you say you believe in, right? And so, you know, that, and again, in the bad times, everybody's your friend. Everybody does well when things are good. But when things are bad, that's when you really understand who you are as an individual, who you are as a company. And it was a very interesting time period during the recent COVID time, which was the most recent, you know, stress period.
Well, speaking of stress periods, Jeffrey, you're about to enter the hot seat.
Oh. He's in Florida. He's ready for it.
Yeah, that's right. You're making me sweat. Now I got to take my
sweater off. Yeah. Stress period began.
I have full faith in you. If you could handle what you handled from growing up, you're good.
Okay.
So do you have any books or podcasts that you might recommend?
Well, I have a guilty pleasure. All right. I must admit that, you know, I do read a lot, but I will say that the business that we're in, it can be very stressful. There's lots of variability. And so I do like to escape to science fiction. So I'll admit it. I'm here. I'll admit it.
Great.
You know, I
like being a nerd too.
Yeah, I do like it. And you know what it does for me? It lets me, for that period of time, sort of not think about all of the various stress factors and all of the various issues and problems that are going on. And so it allows me to step. So that's my guilty pleasure. Sorry.
I love it.
Right. Like, things aren't so bad in my business. I could be getting chased by a dragon.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Oh man, that's funny. What is your most memorable deal when you think about your career? Like, wow, that one was difficult, or one that really catapulted me, or something along those lines.
So during COVID, we bought a shopping center called The Avenue, which is in, I think we bought it in 2020. And, you know, that was when nobody was paying rent. And the question was whether people were going to pay rent and whether retail was really going to continue. And it was a big purchase for us. I think at the time it was $150 million. You know, maybe give or take a couple of bucks. So decent sized purchase, right? So lots of risk. And we decided as a group that we believed in our business. We believed in our business plan. We had to convince our investors that, you know, what we were doing was not going to fail and we weren't going to lose everybody's money. And I remember Sunday morning, we have to close Monday, and the seller was a big REIT. And at the time, you know, the bank that we were dealing with was a Texas-based bank, and they had very specific processes. And so we're on the phone with the bank on Sunday morning going through their checklist of items, and there's some things missing. And so, you know, and you have to remember, so I'm personally guaranteeing a loan. The loan's like $90 million, right? So, and, you know, with our team members believe in what we're doing. But I sat there and said, okay, this is a bet the farm type of situation, because if we're wrong about real estate, if we're wrong about retail, if what we believe is not going to happen, we've basically just made ourselves, you know, basically lost everything, because I guaranteed. And so I told my wife, I said, listen, either we're going to be living in one of our rental houses, you know, we'll have to move in there, or we'll be doing okay. And so that's the type of, you know, bet the farm. But I have to tell you, we all believed in what we were doing. We believed in the asset class, and we've been doing it for so long. We said, there is no way that we're wrong. Everybody else believes we're going to fail. Everybody else believes that this asset class is going to go down the tubes. Everybody believes that, you know, we're doomed. We didn't believe that. And so we took that massive risk. And I just remember sitting there going, either I'm going to be super poor and living in one of my rental homes, or I'm going to be
pushing
doing
shopping
carts. So pushing shopping carts. Yeah. But so today, obviously, that's recovered and we're doing just fine.
So, Jeffrey, I'm sure you've hired a tremendous amount of people throughout the years. What do you look for when you hire someone?
So we touched on this a little bit earlier.
Yes.
Because, you know, I'm always the last person to interview. And so I don't ask questions about, you know, what your skill sets are, or why do you want to work here? My question is, as we talked about earlier, is, you know, the last places that you work, tell me about your core values.
Right.
Tell me how you saw them implemented at the company. Tell me, you know, what you think of, you know, the company and how do your managers implement it? Tell me a difficult time that your company went through and how they reacted. And so those are the questions I generally ask, right? And so I remember I was getting my MBA. I went to North Chapel Hill for my MBA. And I was getting my MBA and I was sitting in an interview. And the interview for this particular job, the interviewer asked me, what is your biggest failure? So they didn't want to hear about success. They wanted to hear about failure, and they wanted to hear about how you recovered from a big failure. And so I always look at, you know, achieving core values, viewing what the company does and how it reacts as either, you know, a potential really positive thing, or, you know, maybe it is a failure. And then if it is a failure, how do you recover from that? And so that's my, I always do that for, that's my last, you know, interview question that I get. And we do a very thorough interview process for people we hire. And unfortunately, I'm the last person in the chain. And that's my question.
They're qualified when they get to you. So
we're going to add that question to our list, Lisa, for people.
I know.
Like it.
I like it.
That's a good question. It's amazing what you hear. I mean, people who are interested in their companies, who pay attention, know what the core values are. And they may not remember them from the website or from reading them, but they know them based upon how their team, how their boss, how their company reacts to certain situations, right?
There might be a written core value, but then there's an actual core value.
Right, right. And there are a couple of sayings Warren Buffett has that, you know, I really love. And a couple of them are, you know, when it's raining gold, put out a bucket, not a thimble. And I always think about that from COVID, right? So when it was raining, what we thought was raining gold. And so we were aggressive during COVID. But the other saying, which I always think about, which is lose money for me, and that's okay. Lose a shred of my reputation and I'll be ruthless. And I may have jumbled it a little bit, but in general, you know, lose my reputation, damage my reputation, harm me out in the marketplace, and I will be ruthless. And so, you know, you think about that as a business model. You know, I think about that a lot.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just said that's, you know, part of, I mean, that's why core values are important.
Well, you mentioned your grandfather and your father being mentors. Are there any other mentors you'd like to give recognition to?
I don't think so. I mean, as I mentioned, I think about my grandfather a lot. I think about his tenacity and his strength. You know, one of the comments always that were related to him was, you know, tough but fair. My grandfather was a tough guy. He was a really tough individual, but the people who worked for him, and we ended up with about 4,500 employees at the time, always viewed him as fair.
And what was your grandfather's name?
William Rosenberg.
William Rosenberg. Love it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I'm sure he's proud of you, Jeffrey. And I really appreciate you coming on this podcast, and Lisa does too. So thank you for sharing your story with us.
Yeah. Happy to be here. Glad to talk about core values. Happy to talk about it anytime.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Resume, a Jackson Lucas podcast, where we take a deep dive into the career journeys of some of the top minds in real estate and equip you with the knowledge to move forward in your path towards the success you've envisioned. Make sure to like, share, and subscribe to Beyond the Resume. We're grateful for your support. All episodes of Beyond the Resume are brought to you by Jackson Lucas, building inclusive and diverse businesses through talent acquisition. Visit us at jacksonlucas.com